General name, real nine.
No, we were. I was asking you whether you were surprised when you learned that you had been awarded the Victoria Cross for this episode.
Well, the circumstances leading up to it were that when that evening I got back to the battalion headquarters again, all I knew was that the CO of the Devons, Colonel Travers, whom I knew very well from working in the trenches, in fact, he was quite a great friend of mine, he said, I will see that the brigadier knows what you've done today. And I just thanked him and didn't think any more about it. Then, when I got back to my field company headquarters that evening and told my OC what had happened during the day, he said, "Oh," if you're not careful, Neame, you'll be getting the VC. Well, I'd never thought anything about it, and didn't even then. I thought he was joking in a sort of a way. And then the day, one or 2 days after, the chief engineer of the Corps, a brigadier, came up to visit us, which he did from time to time, to visit the field companies of the division. And he said to me, having been told about this by the CRE and the field company commander, he said, "I'll see that my corps commander hears about this, Neame." And I thanked him and didn't think anything special about it until on Christmas Day, that's 6 days after the events, our divisional commander, Major General Davis, who afterwards became General Sir Francis Davis, came round to our billets and just to wish the people who weren't out working, and I wasn't that morning, Happy Christmas, and said to me, he said, "Happy Christmas to you, Neame. I've recommended you for the Victoria Cross." And so that was the first time I really thought knew about it seriously.
When he said that to you, how did you react at the time?
Well, I just said, "Well, thank you very much, sir." And his ADC came up to me afterwards and said, "Well, that's a nice Christmas present, Neame, isn't it?" Well, then I still didn't write home and tell my parents. I'd written in my letters and told them about the exciting battle I'd had, but I still didn't tell them about being recommended for the VC because I was still no conviction that I would get it, and I didn't want them to be disappointed. But however, they heard in a roundabout way from an officer whose parents lived near us at home, an officer in our division who'd heard all about it and wrote to his parents, and it got through that way. They knew that I'd been recommended for the VC.
Yes. After the award had been granted to you, how did you find holding the Victoria Cross affected people's attitudes to you when they learned that you were the holder of the highest award for gallantry? Could you notice any differences in people's reactions?
Well, to some extent, I think the soldiers, my own sappers and other soldiers, you know, they rather buck them up, and they do things for you in the field, you know, in presenting on, but I generally speaking, I didn't affect things greatly, but I think one did notice that in the field and in battle or anything, the troops would they would take notice.
Did you find that having the VC was a significant help to you in your later career? In any way at all?
Well, I suppose I think I must say it must have been. Things like getting promotion on the staff and so on. I got selected later on in the war for staff appointments, which I think it must have been a help. And then after the war, I was chosen to go as an instructor at the staff college. Instead of going as a student, my name had been put down to go as a student. I'd never been to staff college. I was put down to go as a student. And then a few months, well, just soon after the armistice, I was told I was going as an instructor when the staff college reopened in 1919. And I know the first commandant had been a senior staff officer in the 8th Division, where I won the Victoria Cross. I think it may have all had some influence, but also I'd served under that, the commandant. I'd served under him in several appointments during the war, so he knew me well.
I see. Have you over the years personally sort of developed your own personal philosophy or come to any conclusions about the kind of people who win awards for gallantry? I mean, for example, perhaps through your contacts in the VC and GC Association, have you kind of thought to yourself, well, there are some common denominators amongst these people which I can notice, or is there no pattern at all? It's really a question related to sort of some kind of definition of what makes a brave person, I suppose.
Very difficult to say. I think they've got to have a steady nerve. That's what it comes to.
I wondered, for example, whether there would, generally speaking, be people who were of the athletic rather than, say, academic bent, perhaps. Have you noticed any correlations or come to any conclusions on points like that?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think it's largely a matter of character, because I think I've seen people who are not necessarily athletic who've got it. I think it's largely a matter of character, whether the fellow's got the guts to face up to certain forms of danger. That's what it comes to.
I wonder if you found at any stage subsequent to winning the VC that it proved to be a nuisance or a handicap or embarrass you or anything like that. Can you remember any incidences which you kind of wish hadn't happened, which were triggered off by your having the VC?
No.
I was thinking of boars at cocktail parties and things like that.
No, I don't think so.
Now, during the Ypres battle, one of the things you've already told me about was the introduction into the British Army, at least for the first time, of hand grenades, which you described as bombs at the time. Why was it, first of all, that hand grenades were considered to be a necessary weapon for you in the 14 trench warfare conditions?
Because the Germans were very well supplied with very well-made hand grenades, and they started using them in trench warfare, and we had no proper reply. And so although there was an official British hand grenade, it had never been used hardly at all in peacetime training, and there was a very, very limited supply of it. And therefore, the Royal Engineers in France started devising homemade hand grenades, which were called bombs. And these were made out of empty, used jam tins, which were filled with rivets, hobnails, any small bits of metal, and the explosive was usually two small bits of gun cotton, and with necessary fuse to set it with a detonator and a necessary bit of fuse projecting from the end of the jam tin. The only snag about this was the difficulty of igniting the fuse, and the easiest way of doing this was with a fusee, which is easily struck on a match, and then the glowing head of the fusee held against the end of the fuse, which leads into the jam tin. Yes.
Why were hand grenades such useful weapons in the conditions of trench warfare?
Trenches are all designed with traverses between each fire bay, with the purpose of preventing the enemy, if they capture a length of trench, preventing him enfilading the whole length of trench.
So this would be a sort of diagonal in the length of the trench?
Yes.
Which would close off the field of fire at regular intervals?
Yes. And the only way of you can't shoot the enemy in the next traverse, as it's called, and the only way of getting at him is by lobbing a hand grenade over the traverse into the next bay of the trench. And the hand grenade goes off with a terrific explosion and is will probably kill or wound all the soldiers in that length of trench. That's the use of the hand grenade in trench warfare.
How was the supply of these hand grenades to the infantry in 1914, before they were regularly issued? How was the supply arranged and organized?
The directly it became clear that the Germans had large numbers of well-manufactured hand grenades. The Royal Engineers in France devised this thing known as the jam tin bomb, and they were made locally in each division in a little homemade factory purely for producing jam tin bombs, and the sappers manufacture them. And in the winter of 1914, they were kept busy manufacturing as many as were needed.
Do you recollect whether they were able to keep up with the needs of the infantry for these hand grenades?
I think they were, yes.
Going on to the end of 1914, there's the most, one of the most publicized events of the winter was the so-called unofficial Christmas truce, which has been variously described in different kinds of books. What are your memories of the Christmas truce in 1914?
On the front of the division I was with, there was complete ceasefire, and I would remember walking along our own front line, but there was no fraternizing. Both our own infantry stood up and strolled about, and the Germans did too, but they never got together and talked to each other at all. The no man's land remained practically empty, and all I recollect is that both sides just strolled about near their own trenches.
And no shots were fired?
No.
Good. I believe at the time you were actually bringing a trench mortar up to the front to use. So how did the Christmas truce affect you?
Yes, I and another sapper officer were taking up the first homemade trench mortar, which we had manufactured in our divisional engineers' workshops, to test in the front line. And when we got up there and found this truce in force, we didn't attempt to use it that day. We took it up on the 26th of December and did use it and lobbed bombs into the German front line successfully. And the